Welcome, everyone. I'm Warren Giroux of Sightline Wealth Management. Today, I'm here with Etienne Bordelot-Lebrec, Vice President, and one of the portfolio managers of the Nine Point Partners Bond Funds. They manage a diversified bond fund, an alternative credit opportunities fund, and a credit income opportunities fund. Welcome, Etienne.
Thanks, Warren. If we can start for
our listeners with a brief overview of each one of the funds that you manage and how they differ from one another.
Sure. And so we have three flavors of bond funds, and our first most plain vanilla, if I can say it like that, because it's not really a plain vanilla bond fund, but it's our low risk rating traditional mutual fund. It's the diversified bond fund. It's kind of a go anywhere bond fund, but we have a few boundaries that we like to respect. It's mostly invested in investment grade credit. We can go up to 40% high yield, but we very rarely go there. But one thing that differentiates it from a traditional bond fund is that we don't track an index. We're really focused on absolute returns. So to do that, we use options, we use swaps, and other types of derivatives to alter the risk-reward characteristics of our fund. We mostly do that to hedge interest rate risk, which is the biggest risk in a bond fund. So that fund is about $600 million as we speak of AUM, and has a track record going back over 10 years. Knock on wood, over the whole track record of the fund, over the whole history, we've never had a negative year. It's been a rough go so far this year, but we're hopeful that we can maintain that track record. The next fund in line is our Nine Point Alternative Credit Opportunities Fund. And I'm going to discuss this fund at the same time as our Credit Income Opportunities Fund, because the Credit Income Opportunities Fund, which is our hedge fund, has been around for a number of years. My partner, Mark Wisniewski, has been managing that strategy in one form or another since 2008. So we have a track record here at Nine Point with this strategy since 2013. It's had really good performance, averaging 6% return since inception with realized volatility of only 4.5%. But some clients don't like investing in hedge funds. They don't like signing the paperwork. So when the liquid alt format was introduced by regulators in Canada a few years ago, we saw that we could replicate the strategy of the Credit Income Opportunities Fund in a liquid alt daily liquidity fund. So that's what we did. So the two funds are managed very close together. So the hedge fund has about 75 million total AUM. And the liquid alt, as we speak, is about 150 million AUM. The liquid alt was launched in May of last year, so we have less than a year of performance under our belt, so we can't really talk about performance for that fund. Both funds manage to a very low duration, so very low interest rate exposure. And the way we do that is by shorting government bonds. So typically, what we would do is we would buy a piece of corporate credit. So let's say a five-year Royal Bank or a five-year Bell Canada. And then against that, to help fund this transaction and reduce the interest rate risk, we would short a five-year Government of Canada bond. So essentially, we isolate the credit spread in these bonds, and that allows us to create a higher yielding fund with a lot less interest rate risk than a traditional fixed income product. I hope that answers your question, Warren.
Yes, it does. That's quite thorough. Just a question on the alternative strategies then. How much leverage would be used in those strategies?
So given that Mark started managing these types of strategies in 2008, he's had experience with what not to do with leverage, meaning, when things get really choppy, you don't want to have too much leverage. And we experienced the same in March of 2020. We had very low leverage going in, and that allowed us to minimize drawdowns and come out strong on the other side. So the short answer is, over the full history of the fund, since inception, on average, we've had one turn of leverage. So for every dollar in the fund of NAV, we would have $1 of extra borrowed money against only investment grade credit. We don't leverage high yield. High yield is already a highly levered company, so we don't use leverage on high yield, only on high quality investment grade.
Okay, so just to be clear, when you said you would buy it in the alternative strategy fund, when you buy a corporate bond, then you offset it with a short of the government. Is that, are they matched maturities? Are they matched dollar amounts? In other words, if you buy $100 worth of corporate, would you short $100 worth of government, and would you match maturities? And what I'm getting at is, it seems to me that it would be the spread, the interest rate spread between the two is what you're really generating. Is that correct? Or yeah. Is that a misconception?
That's how we think about it. So we isolate the credit spread of that issuer, essentially. So actually, I think I'll put that slide in the presentation that we'll post on the website. We have a kind of a stylized portfolio construction slide where we show the core portfolio, which is essentially what we do with our cash, and then what we do with the leverage component of the portfolio. So the core portfolio, where we use cash to buy securities, we generate between 3% and 5% yield in that portfolio. So we buy a combination of investment grade credit, a little bit of high yield, perhaps a few prefs when it makes sense, and that we manage this portfolio to have a duration of between 0 and 5 years. So fairly low interest rate sensitivity, and then you tack onto that the levered portion of the portfolio, where we short the 5-year government bond by a 5-year royal, short the 3-year government bond by a 3-year Bell Canada, and so on and so forth. That levered portfolio has no interest rate risk whatsoever because it's perfectly matched, and that generates 1.5% to 3% extra income for the portfolio. And that takes us to an overall portfolio yield of between 5% and 8%.
Okay, thanks. So if I talk about a little bit, if we can go back to the diversified bond fund for a moment, as well as the alternative opportunity credit funds. Are you 100% Canada? You said the diversified bond fund, you go anywhere. So if you were to look at the portfolio today, for example, how much would you have in Canada? How much would you have in, say, I just use the US or other markets?
Yeah, so, you know, we have the ability to go anywhere, but to be perfectly honest, like, our specialty is North America. We're here in North America. We know the companies well. We know the market and microstructure well. We rarely venture outside of North America. On the odd time we've gone to Europe, when there's a real interesting opportunity, like in 2018, 2019, when there was the trade war between the US and China, and Europe was looking like it was slowing down. At that point, we bought government bonds in Europe, France and Germany. So that's rare. Most of the time we'll be kind of call it 70 to 80% Canada, and the rest in the United States. We're very mindful of foreign exchange exposure. We don't like to take foreign exchange exposure. That's just one more risk in the portfolio. So because of the way FX forwards line up, sometimes it costs you money to hedge US dollars or euros, and sometimes it's a net benefit. So that cost or benefit is really what we look at when we decide to invest abroad.
So would you naturally hedge the portfolio then? If you went into the US, yeah. Would you automatically hedge it?
Yeah. So we're 100% hedged. It's very rare that we take any sort of foreign exchange exposure. And when we do, it's very small. Like over the last several years, I think the highest net unhedged foreign exchange exposure was around 5-6%.
Okay. Now, would that same apply to the alternative opportunity credit funds that you're primarily, you're just North American based? And
it's our policy across all the funds. We hedge FX exposure for the most part, and we're mostly focused in North America. We have the same philosophy across all our funds. It's just there's slight variations for investors that want something that's a little bit more low risk or a bit more liquidity, all the way up to our hedge fund, which has a little bit less liquidity. It's a monthly fund and a little bit more volatility, but also comes with more return. So we try to keep a clean offering of different products that fit different investor risk appetites.
A question regarding sort of the sectors of each one of the funds. So what would you have in governments versus, say, corporates and, say, high risk in each one of the portfolios?
Yeah, so it varies a lot. A lot of what we do starts with a top-down view of the world. Think very simply about the economic cycle. There's times where it's kind of risk on. Central banks are on hold. They're not raising rates. They're not cutting rates. Typically, equity markets do fairly well. So that's when you call it early cycle, earlier in the economic cycle. That was like last year or end of 2020, 2021. We're happy having a little bit more duration in our portfolio, a little bit more high yield, a little bit more leverage. And then when you start pivoting towards an environment like what feels like we're in now, where central banks are talking about raising rates, economic activity maybe is starting to slow down a little bit because of central bank action. So that's an environment where we take duration down a lot. We start reducing credit risk in the portfolios. Don't really involve governments yet because they don't yield much at this juncture. And then we also start reducing leverage in the funds where we have leverage. And then once the yield curve is inverted, central banks have pretty much stopped raising rates, but the yield curve is flat as a pancake, almost and a little bit inverted, then that's when we start adding government bonds back in the portfolio. And we make sure that we have very low credit risk, very low leverage, and kind of brace for the recession, so that when things get choppy, we have some dry powder to take advantage of opportunities. And that's how we played it in 2020. That's how we played it in 2015, 2016. And we just, obviously we don't have a crystal ball, but we try to be directionally accurate in where we are at in the economic cycle, following what central banks are doing, and pre-positioning ourselves for the next step.
Okay, thanks. I think that pretty well covers the description of the strategy. So let's move on into what you're thinking today, what your macro view is going out over the next 3, 6 months, a year, although a year right now, given all the turmoil in the marketplace, is probably a little stretch. But what are you thinking about rates, and how do you have the portfolios positioned sort of today?
Yeah, so I'm going to backtrack maybe 8 or 9 months, and I think that's going to help you understand how we got to where we are and how we've positioned the portfolio for this, or the portfolios, I should say. So if you backtrack to June of last year, June of 2021, we saw an important pivot at the Fed in particular, where they had been telling us all along that what they mostly cared about was unemployment. And all of a sudden, they seemed to be starting to worry about inflation. Everybody was expecting inflation to taper off sometime in the summer / fall of 2021. And you could tell that the June FOMC meeting was a big pivot. And we were also watching inflation in the summer and fall of 2021 for cues as to whether or not it would taper off or if we would have bigger inflation problems. And as we all know, it didn't taper off. It kept accelerating. So at that point, in the fall of 2021, it became clear that central banks were getting very worried about inflation and that they're going to quickly pivot to a more hawkish stance. So we started hedging our interest rate risk in the diversified bond fund. We don't have a lot of interest rate risk in the other two mandates, the liquid alt and the hedge fund. But we converted a lot of our holdings into floating rate securities to prepare for raising rates. That's kind of the best place to hide when rates are going up is to layer in some floating rate exposure. So that's what we did through the fall to reduce the duration of the diversified bond fund all the way down to just over two years of duration. It was about 5 years in the summer of 2021. So pretty drastic reduction in duration. And here we are now with inflation still very high, and the war in Ukraine is not helping on that front. If the situation had been different, if inflation had been well contained, and we had had that shock with commodity prices going up because of the war in Ukraine, I think central banks would have looked through that. But given the current environment and the fear of a wage price spiral in many countries, particularly the U.S. and Canada, we think that central banks are going to be more aggressive to try to contain inflation. So the market's pricing in about 7 rate hikes this year by the Fed and about the same by the Bank of Canada. We think that's probably about right. So they'll take rates back to just under 2% by the end of this year. Big question is, what happens next year? Do we start to see the economy slow down? Or is the economy keeping its current strength into next year? And then do they keep raising rates again next year? So we're going to be watching a couple of things. We want to see what happens with inflation, particularly goods inflation, as we move through the summer. So that's going to be one thing we're going to be on the lookout for. Also, how long does this war in Ukraine persist? We're by no means geopolitical strategists or military strategists, so we don't know. But for now, with the duration of our portfolios where it is, so the diversified bond fund, about 2.7 years, maybe a little bit less at this juncture, and the other two funds are under 2 years of duration. So the liquid alt is 1.9 years. The credit income opportunities fund is 1.5 years. So we've taken out most of the interest rate risk in our funds. So from here on, rates can go up. It really shouldn't have much of an impact on our strategies. So we're well covered on this front. What's more important is what happens with risk assets and in particular credit spreads, because we obviously have corporate bonds and some high yield bonds still in our portfolios. Those have sold off materially since the beginning of this year. Just generically speaking, in Canada, corporate spreads are up by over 50 basis points. That's a pretty big move. That's almost as wide as where credit spreads were at the height of the Eurozone debt crisis in 2012, if you remember. So things have gone a bit too far too fast. Credit spreads are, in our opinion, at this juncture, quite attractive. We don't think Canada and the U.S. is going into recession anytime soon. So we think it's a nice time to increase exposure to credit if clients have some dry powder, because we're probably going to snap back here in the next few months. Longer term, going into this second half of this year and into 2023, following our playbook, we're going to, as rates go up, we're going to start reducing credit exposure and preparing for the next downturn. I mean, we don't know when the next downturn is going to be, but if central banks are as aggressive as they say they will be raising rates, we expect the yield curve to flatten and invert sometime in 2023. That's typically your signal for the next recession, 6 to 12 months in front of you. So maybe a recession sometime late 2023, early 2024 should be kind of our base case, depending on what happens. But obviously, things have been very volatile. This cycle has happened about 5 times faster than last cycle. So, things can change. So we try to stay nimble and open-minded about the environment.
What do you think about the magnitude of the rate increases? A lot of pundits out there, you just mentioned 7 or 8 rate increases. I think that's pretty generally accepted consensus view. But what about magnitude? Some of the Fed chairmen have come out and said that they'd be open to a 50% or 50 basis point rate increase as opposed to 25. The first one was 25. Do you see that maybe the rate increase accelerating if inflation is not sort of slowing at all, the pace of inflation?
Yeah, so, you know, I think they're getting antsy to get off the lower bound. So they raised rates 25 beeps, was it last week, 2 weeks ago? Right. And they don't have a meeting in April. They have a meeting in May and June and July. Would they do 50 beeps to kind of get up the lower bound faster and get to call it 1.25% by the summer? That's possible. Do they want to really rock the boat and shock everybody and do 50, 50, 50 three times in a row? I don't think so. Their goal is not to kill the economy here. There's a midterm election coming up in the fall. I think the Fed's going to be treading very carefully, trying, you know, the economy is strong, and this commodity shock that we're seeing, yes, it's having a big impact in Europe, which is a net energy importer. But Canada, the U.S., we produce a lot of commodities. We're net energy exporters now, even the U.S., since the shale revolution. So and unemployment's at all-time lows. There's 10 times more job openings than people looking for jobs. The economy is still very strong, and it takes a while for rate hikes to feed through the economy. So, yeah, I think they might accelerate the pace of rate hikes a little bit into the summer and then kind of take a break, see what happens with inflation, see what happens with the war in Ukraine, see what happens with demand, because, you know, all these government programs that were supercharging demand last year have rolled off, and now we're going to see what the real economy looks like without government support. So I don't know that they want to act too rashly and push us into a recession that quickly. So I think they're walking a fine line, and they want to make sure that the investment community acknowledges that rates are going to go up faster than last cycle because conditions are quite different. But I don't think that they will act incrementally more hawkishly than they have already postured.
Yeah, sort of another question, a little bit maybe philosophical to a point, but I'm just curious what your thinking is on increasing rates at this juncture. We've had an enormous amount of liquidity pumped in the system. I mean, we've had negative rates in Europe, for example, since 2013, 2014. In an effort to stimulate some inflation. It didn't happen. We had, you know, lots of liquidity in the system in North America as well over that period of time with extremely low rates, historic low rates. It didn't really generate any inflation. And then all of a sudden we had COVID. Again, they pumped the system full of liquidity with COVID, and all of a sudden we had inflation. But a good part of this inflation is a result of shortages of materials, shortages of labor, supply chain disruption, et cetera, et cetera. So giving that sort of environment, and one of the reasons for our inflation that we have now, do you think rates are going to be as impactful as they might be if it was just pure liquidity that was driving inflation?
But so here's so the difference between this time and last time, I think, is if you think about the post-global financial crisis, it took a long time for demand to come back. This time around, it's very different. Yes, they pumped the system full of liquidity, But at the same time, COVID is a negative supply shock. You can't produce, so supply chain disruption reduces supply. Increased health and safety protocols while reduces supply. You need more people to do the same work you did before. More people are off work because they're sick and so on and so forth. So COVID was at once a negative supply shock. And at the same time, government gave so much money to everybody that it was a positive demand shock. So you boost demand by giving everybody a bunch of cash, and then you decrease supply because of the COVID environment and the health restrictions we were faced with. That's just simple macroeconomics or even microeconomics, just economics 101. Boost demand, reduce supply. What happens? Prices go up. So there is no such demand boost post the global financial crisis. It took a long time to repair that demand. So I think that this is the mistake this time around. And as we kind of exhaust this excess demand and supply comes back, and quite frankly, one risk that I see of this whole environment is supply is responding too much to this demand that might prove to be very temporary. So that's clearly a risk over the next year or two, is that, you know, all this excess demand that companies have faced, they're responding to this demand, they're trying to increase supply. Will they increase supply by too much? And when the excess demand fades, and higher rates will also have an impact on that, particularly on the housing and the auto front. Could we be seeing companies with excess inventories and then they're starting to be forced to slash prices? And that's kind of the normal economic, what's the word I'm looking for? That would be what you would expect through a normal economic cycle, you know, and the good old inventory boom and bust. So in the back of my mind, that's why I'm watching inflation, particularly goods inflation. That's why I'm watching inventory levels in the U.S. in particular, because I have a sneaky suspicion that we might be this inflation problem might be resolving itself just a lot faster than past cycles because of the dynamics that were established here.
Okay, that's good. That's a good point. I think that pretty well covers everything that I wanted to discuss. Is there anything that you want to leave our listeners with regarding your thinking on rates or your particular funds in particular?
Yeah. So I think fixed income is an important part of a lot of people's portfolios. And, since the 1980s, it's been a fairly easy asset class to be involved in. Interest rates, for the most part, were going down and government bonds were offering a yield that was somewhat attractive. But it's becoming a much more challenging environment for traditional bond funds that own a very large proportion of government or semi-government bonds. So I think clients should be looking for more active strategies in fixed income, and we are one of those strategies. We are very active through the cycle, managing interest rate risk in particular, which is the biggest risk in bond portfolios. And as rates go up now, bond funds are one, suffering heavy losses in most cases. The global bond index is down 10% from its peak, so a pretty big drawdown. Thankfully, our funds have done a lot better than that, given our interest rate positioning. But it's going to be a challenging environment for bond funds over the next several months. So I highly encourage clients to look for more active, more alternative strategies to manage their fixed income money, because this is where you can really improve outcomes and reduce volatility.
Okay, thank you. I, It just brought to mind another question that I should have asked you earlier. A lot of people are talking about normalized interest rates. What does that really mean? What is a normal interest rate? And what does normalizing mean relative to that?
Boy, I don't. That's a good question. I'm gonna take a shot at it, but by no means should this be considered a definitive answer. I think when people say normal interest rates, they mean somewhere around neutral. The neutral rate of interest being this academic concept where it doesn't stimulate nor does it tap the brakes on the economy. People think that neutral rates are around 2.5% in Canada and in the US. So normalizing interest rates means taking them back to neutral. Now, that estimate of the neutral rate varies over time. It used to be much higher, now it's much lower. It has to do with long-term trends like demographics and things like that. Will neutral be 2.5%? I don't know. What I know is that Canada in particular, and more than the US, has very stretched household balance sheets. I think it's going to be fairly challenging for the Bank of Canada to raise rates a lot more past quote-unquote neutral, so past 2.5-3%, before you start to see a real deceleration of demand, particularly housing. Just think back to last time the bank raised rates and everybody was worried about mortgage payments and the impact it was going to have on the economy. So we have a lot more household debt now than we used to. So I think that some of these very important structural factors, like the amount of debt in the economy, the overall age of the population, is going to have an impact on how far they can raise rates before they achieve the desired outcome, which is to take inflation back to towards their target of around 2%. I'm not in the camp that believes that they need to raise rates to like 3.5, 4, 5% before inflation comes back under control. I think it's going to happen faster than that.
So Etienne, given your scenario there and normalized rates, what would you say, what would that mean on a 10-year bond, for example, a 10-year Canada, 10-year US Treasury?
Yeah, 10-year Canada is already 2.25, 2.3%. Can we sell off a little bit more here? I mean, here's the thing. Central bankers have told us they want to raise rates, but we haven't seen those rate increases yet. We've seen one out of the Bank of Canada, one out of the Fed. There's going to be a lot of water under the bridge before we see all of these rate increases that everybody's predicting. So I think we've seen the market participants, the sell side, research shops, almost outdoing themselves, trying to be more and more hawkish and pricing in more and more rate hikes. I think at some point that's going to stop because we need to see those rate hikes being realized and see the real impact of those rate hikes flow through the economy. When I used to work at the Bank of Canada, the kind of rule of thumb was 6 to 18 months is how long it takes for one rate hike to make its way through the whole economy. Let's not get ahead of our skis, and let's see how many rate hikes they can put through before they slow demand enough that that inflation comes back towards target. And if I'm right, and then that they only go to 2.5-3%, well, that means that 10-year bond yield is probably capped around 2.5-2.75. So maybe another 20-30 basis points more to sell off. But we've done a lot of work already. I think in March alone, 10-year rates moved 70 bps. That's a massive move.
Ed, it's a massive move, but we still have negative real yields, don't we? And that will have to eventually right itself, I would think. Is that fair to say?
If you think inflation is going to stay at 7%, then if you want positive real yield, you need the Fed funds rate or the overnight rate to move to 7%. So I think that the combination of slower demand, more supply, I mean, inflation in a way is pushing people back into the workforce because they have to work more or start working because they need more money to pay for necessities. So like the economy is dynamic. I don't think that the current inflation rate should be extrapolated and say that's where we need to go to have real yields that are zero or positive. So I think that the wheels are in motion to solve some of these problems, and it's going to take time. But I'm not in the camp that calls for 4 or 5% interest rates. I don't think the economy can sustain that very long.
Yeah, it certainly would seem that that would be a little excessive at this point, because I'm in your camp as well. I think the economy sort of, I hate to use the word, but a little bit as strong as it is, it's also a little bit fragile at the same time, and could change directions very quickly. So, well, Etienne, I think that will pretty well wraps it up. I want to thank you for taking the time, and we certainly look forward to speaking with you in the future. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Warren, and have a great day.